Winding down the stairway, I smelled the familiar moist fragrance, all the while doubting I would ever stand here in this great tree again. I paused to examine the curious script that covered Arbas's walls. Rhea, already at the bottom, called up to me.
Let's go!
I'm just taking a last look at this writing. Even in the spare light of the stairwell, her puzzlement was clear.
Writing? What writing?
On the wall, here. Don't you see it? She climbed back up to me. After staring at the spot where I pointed, she seemed baffled as if she saw nothing there.
Can you read it?
No.
But you can see it?
Yes. For a moment she scrutinized me.
There is something different about the way you see, isn't there?
I nodded.
You see without your eyes.
Again I nodded.
And you can see something I can't see with eyes.
Rhea bit her lip.
You are even more of a stranger to me now than when I first met you.
Maybe it's better for you I stay a stranger. Trouble fluttered his wings nervously.
He doesn't like it in here,
she observed, heading down the stairs. I followed. He probably knows what Arbasa thinks of him. After a pause, I added, not to mention what I think of him. The doorway creaked, then opened. We stepped through it into the morning light scattered by the leafy boughs overhead, even as the passage snapped shut behind us. Rhea glanced upward into the broad boughs of Arbasa, then quickly moved into the forest. As I followed, my walking jarred Trouble, and his talons squeezed me tighter than ever. Before long, she came to a large beech tree, its gray bark folded with age.
Come here,
she called.
I have something to show you.
I approached. She took her hand and laid it flat against the trunk.
No tree is as ready to speak as a beech, especially an elder. Listen.
Gazing up into the branches, she started making a slow, swishing sound with her voice. Immediately, the branches began to wave in response, whispering gently. As she varied her pace, pitch, and volume, the tree seemed to reply in kind. Soon the girl and the tree were engaged in full and lively conversation. After a time, Rhea turned to me and spoke again in our own language.
Now you try it.
Me?
You. First, put your hand on the trunk.
Still doubtful, I obeyed.
Now, before you speak, listen.
I already heard the branches.
Don't listen with your ears. Listen with your hand.
My palm pressed into the folds of the trunk. My fingers joined with the cold, smooth bark. Presently, I could feel a vague pulsing at the edges of my fingertips. The pulsing moved gradually into my whole hand and then up my arm. I could almost feel the subtle rhythm of air and earth flowing through the body of the tree, a rhythm that combined the power of an ocean wave surging with the tenderness of a small child breathing. Without thinking, I started making a swishing sound like Rhea. To my surprise, the branches responded, waving gracefully above me. A whisper stirred the air. I nearly smiled, knowing that while I did not understand its words, the tree was indeed speaking to me. Both to Rhea and the old beech, I said, one day I would like to learn this language.
It would do you no good if the Druma dies. Only here are the trees of Finchaira still awake enough to talk.
I hunched my shoulders. What can I possibly do for you? I already told you I'm not the person in your dream.
Forget my dream. There is something remarkable about you. Something special.
Her words warmed me. Even if I didn't really believe them, it meant something that she did. For the first time in what seemed like ages, I thought of myself seated on the grass, concentrating on a flower, making it open its petals one by one. Then I remembered where that path had taken me, and I shuddered. Once there was something special, but that part of me is gone. Her gray-blue eyes burrowed deeper.
Whatever it is you have, it is with you right now.
I have only myself and my quest. which will probably take me far from here. Adamantly, she shook her head.
That is not all you have.
All at once, I understood what she must be talking about. The Galator. She didn't want me, after all. She wanted the pendant I wore, whose power I did not begin to understand. It didn't matter how she had concluded that I carried it. What mattered was that somehow she knew. How foolish of me to have believed, even for an instant, that she had seen something special about me, about my person, rather than my pendant. "You don't really want me," I growled. Her face turned quizzical.
"You think not?"
Before I could answer, Trouble's talons dug into my shoulder with sudden force. I winced with pain. It was all I could do to keep myself from swiping at the bird, but I knew that he might attack me as ferociously as he had attacked the killer rat by the stream. All I could do was try to tolerate the pain, while despairing that he had chosen me to be his perch. But why had he chosen me? What did he really want? I had absolutely no idea.
"Look!"
Rhea pointed at a brilliant flash of iridescent red and purple disappearing into the trees.
"The Ocklea bird!"
She started after it, then paused, glancing back at me.
"Come, let's get closer. The Ocklea bird is a sign of good fortune. I have not seen one for years."
With that, she dashed after the bird. I noticed that the wind seemed to sweep through the trees at that very moment, causing the branches to chatter vigorously. Yet, if they were truly saying something, Kriya was not paying any attention. I rushed after her. Over fallen branches and through needled bracken, we chased the bird. Each time we drew close enough to get a better look, it flew off in a burst of brilliant color, showing only enough of its plumed tail to make us want to see more. Finally, the Ocklea bird settled on a low branch in a stand of dead trees. Most likely it had chosen this place to perch because the supple living branches all around were swaying so wildly in the wind. For the first time, no leaves hid its bright feathers. Rhea and I, panting from the chase, held ourselves as still as possible, studying the flaming purple crest on the bird's head and the explosions of scarlet along its tail. Rhea could hardly contain her excitement.
"Let's see how near we can get."
She started to creep closer, pushing past a dead limb. Suddenly, Trouble whistled sharply. As I cringed from the blast in my ear, the hawk took flight. My heart missed a beat when I realized that he meant to attack the beautiful bird. "No!" I cried. Rhea waved her arms wildly.
"Stop! Stop!"
The merlin paid no attention. Releasing another wrathful whistle, he shot like an arrow straight into his prey. The Ocklea bird, taken unaware, shrieked in pain as Trouble sunk his talons deep into its soft neck and pecked at its eyes. Still, it fought back with surprising savagery. The branch snapped beneath them. Feathers flying, the two birds tumbled to the ground. Rhea ran forward, with me right behind. Reaching the spot, we both froze. Before us, on the brown leaves, Trouble, his talons smeared with blood, stood atop the body of his motionless prey. I noticed that the Ocklea bird seemed to have only one leg. Probably the other one had been torn off in the attack. I felt sick at the sight of those crumpled feathers, those luminous wings that would never fly again. Then, as we watched in amazement, the Ocklea bird began to metamorphose. As it changed, it pulled away from its former skin, much like a snake that is shedding. This left behind a brittle, almost transparent skin, marked with ridges where the feathers had been. Meanwhile, the bird's wings evaporated as the feathered tail transformed into a long, serpentine body covered by dull red scales. The head grew longer and sprouted massive jaws, filled with jagged teeth that could easily bite off a hand. Only the eyes, as red as the scales, remained unchanged. The serpent-like creature lay dead, the thin skin of its former body clinging to its side. I took Rhea's arm. "What does this mean?" Her face drained of color, she turned slowly toward me.
"It means that your hawk has saved our lives."
"What is that thing?"
"That is, or was, a shifting wraith. It can change into whatever shape it wants, so it is especially dangerous.
Those jaws look dangerous enough. Grimly, Rhea poked at the shed skin with a stick.
As I said, a shifting wraith can change into anything, but there is always a flaw, something that gives it away if you look closely enough.
The bird had only one leg. Rhea motioned toward the still whispering branches beyond the dead stand.
The trees tried to warn me, but I wasn't listening. A shifting wraith in the Druma, that has never happened before. Oh, Emrys, my dream is coming true before my eyes.
I bent low and extended my hand toward the Merlin, now preening his wings. Trouble cocked his head to one side, then the other, then hopped onto my waiting wrist. With quick sideways steps, he climbed up my arm and sat once more on my shoulder. Yet this time his weight didn't feel so troublesome. I faced Rhea, whose brow was wrinkled with foreboding.
All of us were wrong about this little fighter. Even Arbasa was wrong.
She shook her head.
Arbasa was not wrong.
But
when Arbasa closed the door, it was not to keep out the Merlin.
She drew a long breath.
It was to keep out you.
I stepped backward. The tree thinks I could be dangerous to you?
That's right.
Do you believe that?
Yes. But I decided to let you in anyway.
Why? That was before your dream. She studied me curiously.
One day, perhaps, I will tell you.
Chapter 18. The Name of the King. My second sight moved from the skin of the shifting wraith, as brittle as a dried leaf, to the living, whispering boughs of the Druma.
Tell me what is happening to Finkaira?
Rhea frowned, such an unnatural expression for her.
I only know a little, what I've learned from the trees. Tell me what you know.
She reached toward me, wrapping one of her forefingers around one of mine.
It reminds me of a basket of sweet berries that turns sour, too sour to eat.
She gave a sigh.
Some years ago, strange things, evil things, started happening. The lands east of the river, once nearly as green and full of life as this forest, fell to the blight. As the land darkened, so did the sky. But until today, the Druma has always been safe. Its power was so strong, no enemies dared to enter. Until now.
How many wraiths are there?
Trouble fluttered his wings, then grew quiet again.
I don't know.
Her frown deepened.
But the shifting wraiths are not even our worst enemies. There are warrior goblins. They used to stay underground in their caves, but now they run free and they kill just for pleasure. There are Ghouliants, the deathless warriors who guard the shrouded castle. And there is Stangmar, the king who commands them all.
At the mention of that name, the living branches surrounding the stand of dead trees started shaking and clacking. When at last they grew still, I asked,
Who is this king?
Rhea chewed her lip.
Stangmar is terrible, too terrible for words. It's hard to believe, but I've heard the trees say that when he first came to power, he wasn't so wicked. In those days, he sometimes rode through the Druma on his great black horse, even pausing to listen to the voices of the forest. Then something happened to him, no one knows what, that made him change. He destroyed his own castle, a place of music and friendship. And where it stood, he built the Shrouded Castle, a place of cruelty and terror.
She sat solemnly for a moment.
It lies far to the east in the darkest of the dark hills, where the night never ends. I've heard of no one, other than the king's own servants, who has gone there and returned alive. No one. So the truth is difficult to know. Yet it is said that the castle is always dark and always spinning, so fast that no one could ever attack it.
I stiffened, remembering my dream at sea. Even now that terrible castle felt all too real.
Meanwhile, Stangmar has poisoned much of Finkaira. All the lands east of the Druma, and some to the south, have been cleansed, as those loyal to him would say. What that really means is that fear, cold, lifeless fear, has covered everything. It reminds me of snow, except snow is pretty. Villages are burned, trees and rivers are silent, animals and birds are dead, and the giants are gone.
Giants? Her eyes burned angrily.
Our first and oldest people. Giants from every land call Finkaira their ancestral home. Even before the rivers began rolling down from the mountains, the footsteps of giants marked Finkaira. Long before Abasa first sprouted as a seedling, their rumbling chants echoed over ridges and forests. Even now, the Kledra, their oldest chant, is the first song many babies ever hear.
The Kledra. Had I heard that name before? It seemed familiar somehow. But how could it be, unless perhaps it was one of Branwen's chants?
They can grow taller than a tree, our giants, or even a hillside. Yet throughout the ages they've stayed peaceful, except for the wars of terror long ago, when goblins tried to overrun the giants' ancient city of Varigo. Usually, unless someone makes them angry, they are as gentle as butterflies.
She stamped her foot on the ground.
But some years ago, Stangmar issued a command, for some reason known only to him, to kill the giants wherever they were found. Since then, his soldiers have hunted them ruthlessly. Although it takes 20 or more soldiers to kill just one, they nearly always succeed. The city of Varigal, I've heard, is now just a ruin. It's possible that a few giants still survive, disguised as cliffs or crags, but they must always stay in hiding, afraid for their lives. In all my travels through the Druma, I've never seen a single one.
I gazed at the corpse of the shifting wraith.
Isn't there any way to stop this king? If there is, no one has found it. His powers are vast. Besides his army, he has assembled almost all of the treasures of Finkaira.
What are they?
Magical, powerful. The treasures were always used to benefit the land and all its creatures, not just one person, but no more. Now they are his. The Orb of Fire, the Caller of Dreams, the Seven Wise Tools, the sword called Deeper Cut, a sword with two edges, one that can cut right into the soul, and one that can heal any wound. The most beautiful one, the Flowering Harp, whose music can bring springtime to any meadow or hillside. And the most hateful one, the Cauldron of Death.
Her voice fell to a whisper.
Only one of the legendary treasures hasn't yet fallen into his hands. The one whose power is said to be greater than all the rest combined. The one called the Galator.
Beneath my tunic, my heart pulsed against the pendant. Her finger wrapped tighter around mine.
I've heard the trees saying that Stangmar has given up searching for the Galator, that it disappeared from Finkaira some years ago. Yet I've also heard that he is still searching for something that will make his power complete, something he calls the last treasure. That could only mean one thing. The Galator?
Rhea nodded slowly.
Anyone who knows where it's hidden is in the gravest danger.
I could not miss the warning.
You know I have it. Yes,
she replied calmly.
I know.
And you think it could help save the Druma? She pursed her lips in thought.
It might or it might not. Only the Galator itself can say. But I still think you could help.
I stepped back, jabbing my neck on a broken limb. Trouble screeched at me reproachfully. Yet the pain in my neck, like the pain in my ear, didn't distress me. For I had heard in her voice that certain something I had not allowed myself to hear before. She really did see something of value in me. I felt sure that she was mistaken.
But her faith was a kind of treasure itself, as precious in its way as the one around my neck. The words jumped out at me. As precious as the one around my neck. Suddenly I realized that I had my clue, the clue I'd been seeking. Until now I had assumed that the Galator was simply known in Fincaira, not that it truly belonged in Fincaira. Now I knew better. It was the most powerful of this land's ancient treasures, and it may have disappeared around the time Branwen and I washed ashore on Gunith. If only I could find out how the Galator had come into Branwen's hands, or at least learn some more of its secrets, then I might find some of my own secrets as well. "The Galator," I said. "What else do you know about it?" Rhea released my hand.
"Nothing, and now I must go with or without you."
"Where?" She started to speak, then froze, listening. Trouble, clinging firmly to my left shoulder, also froze. Rhea's loose brown hair stirred like the branches as yet another wind moved through the forest. As her features hardened with concentration, I wondered whether her laughter, like bells, would ever ring again among these trees. The sound swelled steadily, a chorus of swishing and creaking, drumming and moaning. As the wind subsided, she leaned toward me.
"Goblins have been seen in the forest. I have no time to lose."
She caught a fold of my tunic.
"Will you come? Will you help me find some way to save the Druma?"
I hesitated.
"Rhea, I'm sorry. The Galator, I need to find out more about it. Can't you understand?"
Her eyes narrowed. Without saying goodbye, she turned to go. I strode up to her and caught a vine from her sleeve.
"I wish you well." "And I wish you well," she said coldly.
A sudden crashing came from the underbrush behind us. We whirled around to see a young stag with the beginning of a rack above its bronze-colored head. The stag leaped over some fallen timber, eager to get away from something. For a split second, I caught a glimpse of one of its brown eyes, dark and deep, filled with fear. I tensed, recalling the one time before when I had seen a stag. Yet that time the fear was in my own eyes. And that time, the stag did everything in its power to help me. Rhea pulled free, then started to go.
"Wait! I will come with you."
Her whole face brightened.
"You will?"
"Yes, but only until our two paths diverge." She nodded.
"For a while, then."
"And where are we going?"
"To find the one creature in all the Druma who might know what to do, the one who is called the Grand Elusa."
For some reason, I wasn't sure I liked the sound of that name.
Chapter 19. Honey. As swiftly as the stag, Rhea bounded off. Although my legs still felt stiff, I tried my best to keep up with her through dense thickets and over moss-banked streams. Even so, she often needed to stop and wait for me. Because the sun rode high above us, sending shafts of light to the forest floor, I could see obstacles much more easily than the night before. Even so, I stumbled often enough that trouble finally took off from my shoulder. He stayed close by, flying from branch to branch, and while my shoulder felt grateful for the rest, I did not resent his watchful eye as I had only a while ago. Animals of all kinds were on the move. Birds with small gray bodies or bright green wings or huge yellow bills, traveling sometimes in flocks and other times alone, flew overhead. Large-eyed squirrels, beavers, a doe with its fawn, and a golden snake also passed me. In the distance, wolves howled. At one point, an enormous shape, black as night, ambled out of the trees. I froze, fearful, until two smaller shapes appeared just behind, and I knew that I had encountered a family of bears. All these creatures shared the same look of fear I had seen in the stag, and all of them, it seemed, were heading in the opposite direction from Rhea and myself.
Late in the morning, perspiration dripping from my brow, I stepped into a shadowed glade. Cedars, very old from the looks of them, stood arranged in a perfect circle. So shaggy was their bark that at first glance they might have been mistaken for an assembly of ancient men whose long manes and beards flowed down over their stooped bodies. Even the sound of their gently stirring branches seemed different from the whispers of other trees, more like people at a funeral humming a solemn, mournful lament. Then I noticed, in the center of the glade, a narrow earthen mound. No wider than my body, it stretched at least twice my own height in length. It was surrounded by round, polished stones which glistened like blue ice. Cautiously, I moved closer. Trouble flew back to my shoulder, but instead of perching himself as usual, he paced back and forth with sharp, agitated steps. I caught my breath. I have been here before. The notion, the conviction, came to me in a fleeting instant. Like a scent of some flower that appears and then vanishes before you have time to find its source. Some dim memory touched me briefly and then fled. Perhaps it was only a dream, or the memory of a dream. Yet I could not shake the feeling that in some way I could not quite identify, this mound within the circle of cedars was familiar.
Emrys, come on!
Rhea's call jarred me back to the present. With a final glance at the mound and at the mournful cedars, I left the glade. Soon I could hear the strange humming no more, but it continued to haunt the darkest corners of my mind. The terrain grew steadily wetter. Frogs piped and bellowed so loudly that sometimes I could not even hear my own breathing. Herons, cranes, and other water birds called to one another in eerie, echoing voices. The air began to reek of things rotting. At last, I saw Rhea standing by the tall grasses at the edge of a dark swath of land. A swamp. Impatiently, she beckoned.
Let's go!
I viewed the swamp skeptically.
We have to cross that? It's the quickest way.
Are you sure?
No, but we are running out of time. Did you see all the animals fleeing? And if it works, it could save us an hour or more. Just on the other side of the swamp are the hills of the Grand Elusa.
She turned to cross the swamp, but I caught her arm.
Just what is the Grand Elusa?
She shook loose.
I don't really know. Her true identity is a secret, even to Arbasa. All I know is that the legends say she lives among the living stones of the Misted Hills, that she knows things no one else knows, including some things that haven't happened yet, and that she is old, very old. I've even heard that she was present when Dagda carved the very first giant from the side of a mountain.
Did you say living stones?
That's what they're called. I'm not sure why.
I glanced toward the murk, studded with dead trees and stagnant pools. A crane cried out in the distance.
Are you sure this creature will help us?
No, but she might. That is, if she doesn't eat us first.
I rocked back on my heels.
Eat us? The legend says she's always hungry, and fiercer than a cornered giant.
Trouble cocked his head toward Rhea. He piped a long, low whistle. She lifted her eyebrows.
What's wrong? Trouble promises to keep us safe, but this is the first time I've heard that note of worry in his voice.
I sniffed. I feel sorry for the Grand Elusa if she should try to eat Trouble. This bird doesn't know the meaning of fear.
That's why I'm not happy to hear him sounding worried.
With that, she turned again to the swamp. She stepped on a slab of caked mud from which she leapt to a rock. As I followed, I noticed we had left our footprints in the mud, but dismissed any concern about leaving tracks. We were already so deep into the forest, it could not matter. We hopped from rock to log to rock again, making our way slowly across the swamp. Snags reached out to us with long, withered arms. Strange voices, somehow different from birds or frogs, echoed across the murky water, joining the occasional whistle from Trouble. Often, as we struggled to keep to the shallower places,
Something would slap the surface of the water or seem to stir within its darkened depths. I could never quite tell what might be causing such disturbances, nor did I really want to know. At length, the swamp faded, even as gray mist began to thicken the air. We came to a wet field of tall grasses which gradually lifted into solid ground. Ahead of us stood a steep, rock-strewn hill where vaporous arms unfurled towards us. Rhea halted.
"The misted hills! If only I could find a cluster of sweet berries, we could use an extra dose of strength for the climb."
She glanced at me uncertainly.
"And for whatever else lies ahead?"
As we started to ascend, Trouble lifted off from my shoulder. He flew in silence, making slow, stately circles in the air above our heads. Although I guessed that he was scanning the forest for any sign of danger, he also seemed to be enjoying himself, savoring the freedom of soaring on high. Boulders, some as big as Rhea's whole house, appeared here and there among the trees. The trees themselves grew farther and farther apart, their gnarled roots grasping the hillside. Yet despite the greater distance between the trunks, the forest didn't seem any lighter. Maybe it was the shadows of the immense boulders, or the curling mist surrounding them, or something else, but the forest felt increasingly dark. As we labored to climb the steep slope, doubts flowed over me like the mist. Whatever kind of being this Grand Elusa was, she certainly didn't pick such a place to live because she enjoyed having visitors. And what if the goblins in the forest found us first? I clutched the Galator beneath my tunic, but I did not feel any better. Suddenly, a great gray stone loomed directly before me. I froze. Perhaps it was only a trick of the mist, confusing my second sight, but it looked less like a boulder than like a face, craggy and mysterious, a face staring straight at me. Then I heard, or thought I heard, a grinding sound, almost like someone clearing his throat. The boulder seemed to shift its weight ever so slightly. I didn't wait to learn what happened next. Up the hill I raced, tripping over roots, rocks, and my own feet. At last, I topped the rise. Above my panting, I heard an angry buzzing sound. Bees, thousands of bees, swarming around the broken trunk of a dead tree. Although it was hard to be certain in the mist, it looked as if the tree had broken off, probably in a storm, not long ago. What was not hard to tell was that the bees were not pleased about it. Rhea, hands on her hips, watched the furious buzzing with interest. Reading her thoughts, I shook my head.
"You're not thinking," I panted, "about going after their honey, are you?"
She grinned slyly.
"A person can never get enough honey. It would just take a minute to fetch some. It wouldn't slow us down." "You can't! Look at all those bees!"
Just then Trouble dropped down, enjoying a final flying swoop before landing on my shoulder. This bird clearly loved to fly. As he settled in, he gave a satisfied chirp. I felt surprised at just how familiar, almost natural, it felt to have him there. So different from yesterday. He folded his banded wings upon his back, cocking his head toward me. On a whim, I winked at him. Trouble winked back. Rhea continued to examine the broken trunk.
"If only I could find some way to distract the bees. Just for a few seconds, that would be enough."
With a sudden screech, Trouble took off again. He flew straight into the swarm. He swooped and dived among the bees, batting them with his wings, then raced away into the mist. The swarm sped after him.
"Madness! That bird likes a fight as much as you like—"
I didn't bother to finish, since Rhea was already scaling the severed trunk in search of the bees' stores of honey. I listened for any buzzing, but heard none. I ran to join her. As I pulled myself up on a low branch, the trunk cracked and wobbled unsteadily on its base.
"Careful, Rhea," I called. "This whole thing could topple over any time."
But she could not hear. Fully occupied, she was already leaning over the jagged top of the trunk.
Standing on the branch, I leaned over beside her. A golden pool of honey, surrounded by walls of honeycomb as thick as my chest, lay beneath us. Bits of broken branches, bark, and honeycomb floated in the heavy syrup. I plunged in my hand, scooped out a heaping handful, then drank the sweet, gooey liquid. I had never in my life tasted such satisfying honey. Rhea apparently agreed, since she was busy feasting with both hands at once, her cheeks and chin dripping.
"We should go," she declared at last. "Have your last swallow."
Seeing a large chunk of honeycomb floating just below me, I grabbed it. As I tugged, however, the honeycomb refused to budge. Bracing myself, I pinched it as hard as I could and yanked with all my might. At that instant, the object rose out of the pool with a deafening howl. I suddenly realized that I had been holding not a honeycomb, but the tip of a huge, bulbous nose. Rhea shrieked as I jerked sideways to get away from the head covered with honey that was lifting toward us. Just then, the base of the thick trunk cracked, tilted, and split apart. It toppled over the side of the hill, taking both of us with it. Chapter 20. Shim. Rhea and I cascaded down the slope. Ahead of us, the weighty log, loaded with honey and whatever had boiled up from its depths, rolled and bounced down the ridge, gathering speed as it descended. Finally, it smashed into a gigantic boulder, splintering into bits. When at last I stopped, the world around me kept spinning for some time. Half dazed, I made myself sit up.
"Rhea? Over here!"
She lifted her head from the grass just below me, her brown wisps of hair matted with honey and twigs. Simultaneously, we turned to the moaning sound coming from the wreckage of the trunk. Rhea reached for me, wrapping her forefinger around mine. We stood and carefully crept closer. What we saw was a little mound, completely covered with honey, sticks, and leaves, lying beneath the boulder. Then the mound rolled over, shook itself vigorously, and sat up.
"It's a man!"
My words were filled with awe.
"A tiny little man." "A dwarf," corrected Rhea. "I didn't know there were any dwarves left in Finkyra."
Two pink eyes popped open in the mask of honey.
"You both is wrong! Totally, horribly, disgustingly wrong! I is no dwarf!"
Rhea looked quite skeptical.
"No? Then what are you?"
The little man blew a blast of honey out of his bulbous nose. As more honey dripped off his chin, he licked his fingers, palms, and wrists. Having cleaned his hands, he looked nervously from one side to the other.
"You isn't a friend of the king's, is you?"
Rhea scowled.
"Of course not."
"And what about your black-haired friend there, who pulls his on other people's noses?"
"He's not either."
"Certainly, definitely, absolutely not?"
Rhea could not keep herself from grinning.
"Certainly, definitely, absolutely not."
"All right, then."
The little man struggled to unstick himself from the ground so that he could stand. He strode up to Rhea. Although he came to only just above her knee, he threw his head back with pride.
"I is no dwarf. I is a giant."
"A what?" I exclaimed, starting to laugh. The little man glared at me, pink eyes shining.
"I is a giant."
Then his pride seemed to melt away. His face fell and his shoulders drooped.
"I is just a very, very, very small giant. I truly wishes that I could be big, like a giant should be."
"I don't believe it." I stooped lower to get a better view.
"You don't look like a giant to me, not even a small one."
"But I is."
"Then I'm a fungus."
"And why is a fungus going around pulsing other people's noses?"
Rhea burst out laughing, shaking every leaf on her suit of vines.
"Leave him alone, Emrys. If he says he's a giant, well then, I believe him."
Seeming vindicated, the tiny fellow patted his bulging belly.
I is having a nicely meal, too, bothering nobodies until I is interrupted.
My name is Hria. What's yours?
Glancing nervously over his shoulder, he muttered,
Can't be too careful these days.
He took a tiny step closer.
My name is Shim.
I observed him suspiciously.
And tell us, Shim, do you always go swimming in your honey when you drink it?
Certainly, definitely, absolutely. If you would like not to get stinged by the bees, that is the best way to do it.
Amused, Rhea smiled.
You have a point, but getting out again must be difficult.
The little giant sputtered.
You is making fun of me?
Not at all, I teased. You're not funny in the least. I tried my best to hold back my laughter, but it spewed out of me all at once. I roared, clutching my side. The tiny fellow darted up to me and kicked me as hard as he could in the foot. My mirth vanished. With a growl, I started after him.
No, stops, please, stops,
cried Shim, hiding behind Rhea's legs.
I doesn't mean to hurt you, really, truly, honestly.
You certainly did.
I tried to grab hold of the sticky mass behind Rhea.
When I catch you, I'll pinch more than your nose.
Wait,
commanded Rhea. She held me by the shoulder.
We don't have time for this. We've dawdled long enough.
Reluctantly, I backed away.
I suppose you're right. Anyway, those bees will be coming back any second with their stingers ready for battle.
I shot a glance at Shim.
If I were you, I'd take a good bath before they descend on you.
The pink eyes swelled in fright.
On me?
Certainly, definitely, absolutely.
The little giant gasped.
I truly hates to get stinged.
With that, he tore off into the swirling mist behind the boulder. He had only just disappeared, however, when he screamed with terror. Rhea and I both ran to see what had happened. A few seconds later, we too screamed. We fell, spinning head over heels, into a deep pit plunging straight into the ground. Eventually, we rolled to a stop. The world had gone totally dark.
Oh, my head, I grumbled.
Something wriggled beneath me.
Gets you off me, you fool!
An arm or a leg, sticky and caked with dirt and leaves, struck me square in the face.
Ow! Watch out, you blundering ball of honey!
Stop it, cried Rhea. We must find our way out of here.
Where is here, anyway? I asked. We must have fallen into a hole, a deep one. So deep I can't even see any light up there. And feel the floor, it's all pokey, not like normal rock.
I can answer your question, boomed a thunderous voice from deeper in the darkness. You have found my lair.
Whose lair?
We all asked at once. A long pause ensued.
The lair of the Grand Elusa.